And now, live from Jerusalem, you're listening to Israel Inspired Radio. Here are your hosts, Rabbis Ari Abramowitz and Jeremy Gimpel.
Shalom and welcome to Israel Inspired on the Land of Israel Network. This is Ari Abramowitz here with my commander in the Israeli army, Jeremy Gimpel. Jeremy, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for letting me be here.
There's a lot to talk about right now. We've been going through some personal shifts in what we do. We're not just doing radio. We used to really just focus on radio because it's a great venue for us. It's a great way to get out complex ideas in more than just one soundbite. But we're seeing that the real way people are consuming media nowadays, just because of the extreme level of overabundance of media flowing from every direction, people are getting it in soundbites. So we're also going to video more and more, and we posted up on YouTube. You just posted what last week? You posted something, and it's got what 100,000 views already.
Yeah.
What was that video?
It was just an understanding, an analysis, really, of President Barack Obama's speech on why he refuses to say radical Islam, and just breaking that speech apart, adding a spiritual insight into what really is going on. And within just a week, our YouTube channel exploded to 30,000 subscribers, and it seems as though this is a new avenue to get the message out.
Yeah, we got 16-17 million hits on our channel. It's really exciting. I wasn't such a fan of that video you made. It was pretty good, but you have a video coming out now that is really good about Brexit and inspired me to make my own video about Brexit, which I think is significantly better than yours, but that's okay. That's okay. There's no competition with us, right?
No competition. But I'll tell you, the thing that's exciting me the most is that we've opened our minds to new forms of communication. And the thing that I am enjoying more than anything else is my WhatsApp group. People have emailed me from all over the world and they've said, Jeremy, I want to join the WhatsApp group. And I have my own community of people that don't know each other. They never communicate with each other. It's only me to them, and then they respond. And it's like personal text messages where I'm able to send them voice messages. I'm able to send them videos. I'm able to send them inspiring quotes of Torah that I read. And there's now a bunch of people that have written in and they say, I want to be a part of this WhatsApp group. And I'm able to communicate so quickly and so personally now with so many people that are like real fans and followers, Talmidim, and really people that just want to hear more of this Israel-inspired message. And it's really changing the way we communicate with the world.
It is, and I'm really happy that you're doing it because your brain has the capacity to be constantly on your phone and writing and doing things. And it's a good way for me to communicate, for me to get the messages out there also. It's really our WhatsApp group. You're just the one that has to deal with it. So grateful for that also. Let's talk for a second about Brexit. This Brexit thing is really a big deal. You know, in rabbis, pastors, imams, we all agree that we're in big times, like we're on the precipice of messianic times. And if all three big religions are on the same page, yes, we all differ significantly with how it's going to look and what's going to look like, but we all feel like these are those times. And it says that in those times, the world will be going through like birth pangs. There will be severe shifts, tectonic shifts, as Netanyahu said, that are going on. And that's true. And you had a message about Brexit, and I want to sort of talk to you about that. Talk it through with you.
Folks, big things are happening. Tectonic plates are shifting and global powers are being reordered.
These stocks were in free fall, the pound historically weak, and the countries in the market for a new prime minister.
Bleeding red across the board as all the major indices fell dramatically. The Dow was down more than 600 points during the day as investors worried what would follow.
What's happening now that Britain left the European Union? Hillary Clinton is trying to take shots at Donald Trump.
We need leaders like yourselves at the local and state and federal level who understand how to work with other leaders to manage risks, who understand that bombastic comments in turbulent times can actually cause more turbulence, and who put the interests of the American people ahead of their personal business interests.
And now Donald Trump is claiming victory for calling the Brexit as he did.
Fairly soon. But I really do see a parallel between what's happening in the United States and what's happening here. People want to see borders. They don't necessarily want people pouring into their country. that they don't know who they are and where they come from. They have no idea. And I think, you know, it not only did it win, but it won by a much bigger margin than people thought it would happen. Well, President Obama did say, I guess, that they should move to the back of the line. That wouldn't happen with me. The UK has been such a great ally for so long. They'll always be at the front of the line. They've been amazing allies in good times and in bad times.
But what's really happening here? Why is it happening? And how is this going to affect Israel and the rest of the world? On the short term, financially, Israel is being rocked as Europe is the primary destination for our exports. And with the euro devalued and the pound plummeting, that's going to shake Israel quite a bit. But in the long term, on a political level, is the dissolvement of the European Union a bad thing? I think no one in Israel is shedding a tear. In the last few years, the European Union has galvanized countries all over the world to give billions of dollars to the Palestinian Authority. The New York Times reported that 87 countries and international organizations pledged $7.4 billion in aid to the Palestinians. Did that money go to building factories, building schools, building hospitals? No, it went to buying missiles, building terror tunnels. 47% of the PA budget goes to civil servants and prisoners, meaning they're paying money to the families of terrorists and they're paying off their own cronies and their terror organizations. So the European Union has galvanized countries to give billions of dollars to nothing. And you wonder why? If you look at all countries around the world, the Palestinians receive more money per capita than any other people anywhere in the world. Look at Syria, Israel's northern neighbors. Over 1 million people have been murdered and killed in the last few years. They don't receive a fraction of the money the Palestinians do. The others will say, well, the Palestinians are looking for self-determination. Well, if it's self-determination, what's going on? How come the Kurds aren't getting money? How come the Tibetans aren't getting any money? Why is the Palestinian organization receiving billions of dollars from the European Union? The European Union in 2014 gave over $139 million to the Palestinian Authority. And that doesn't include other NGOs and other nonprofit humanitarian aid organizations. $140 million. Here's the reason why. The European Union, backed by Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, they have a view of global secularism. Sometimes artists, musicians are able to captivate the ideology of a movement. You all know John Lennon.
Imagine there's no country.
In a world with no religion, no borders, no countries, the entire world just becomes a mishmash of unity, of equality. The Jewish vision given by the prophets of Israel is the exact opposite. It's not secular globalism. Israel claims that every country should be strong, independent. Its own culture should be developed. Its own strengths and gifts should be enhanced. And then all countries come together and they celebrate their differences. They contribute their own gifts to the community, their own capabilities together to create a global community. But it's not just a global community of equality. It's a brotherhood of man under the fatherhood of God, where countries have borders, where countries have a culture, where countries have an identity. And those identities, they come together in a beautiful spectrum like a rainbow. Secular globalism is here to take away our colors and our differences and make us all the same. Which, how can I not bring up the Torah portion of the week, Korach, who said, hey, why don't we all just be holy? Why don't we all wear the same clothes? Why don't we all look the same? Why don't we all be priests? What is this world going towards? What are the ideas that are going to rule the global community? Is it the vision of the prophets of Israel that saw each country, individual, strong, independent, cooperating together? Or is it going to be some mishmash of countries that are controlled by some sort of political elite that will dictate the terms for everyone else beneath them? Very similar to Korach. Our vision is that the independent people are independent countries, and the more freedom to the masses and the less political bureaucracy, the better. And so from Israel, we say, Britain, kol hakavod. Britain, you've done a great thing, and you've led as an example. You are the descendants of Winston Churchill and Margaret Thatcher, and know that your country today, although it's shaking the world to its core, have done something marvelous. And I can only hope that the United States of America, will follow your lead.
Okay, so that is a fantastic clip. I really loved it. I loved the synthesis of the Torah with what's happening, bringing it all together and making sense, because I really think the purpose of our station, of our show in specific, is to synthesize, to bring together what's happening in the world through a Torah prism, through understanding it through a spiritual and historic context. So, you brought up the Korach point in this week's Torah portion, which is significant. Are you pulling...
Yeah, what I want to say about that is it's critical to just pay note and to stand in a little bit of wonder that as the European Union is now dissolving, Korach wanted to create his own form of union where everyone would be the same, and to see the parallels that exactly the week that we're reading from this week's Torah portion, all of this is happening on the global stage, you can't help but feel like there's a divine message for all of us that are living in the rhythm of the Torah portion.
Right, and also what's interesting about Korach is the Torah and our sages and the ethics of our fathers, it talks about motivations. Right, and as Jews, we disagree all the time. We gravitate towards disagreement. We enjoy a good debate. We feel like it refines us, and we're able to, by and large, stay close to each other and stay friends. But it really has to do with what the motivation of the disagreement is. In Ethics of Our Fathers, it says, "Kol machloket shehi l'shem shamayim sofa l'hitkayem." Every argument that's for the sake of heaven will last forever. Interestingly enough, it doesn't say it will be resolved. It says it will last forever, meaning there's something beautiful in the argument in and of itself. It talks about Hillel and Shammai, the two rabbinical houses, and that's an example of that type of argument. But Korach, it says, and if it's not L'shem Shammai, if it's not for the sake of heaven, if there's not pure motivations about it, meaning there's a lot of self-interest there, then the argument will not last forever. It will dissolve. And it says that's the argument between of Korach and his men. Not Korach and Moshe, because Moshe was for the sake of heaven, but Korach and his men. And that's why it's important to look at what's really happening in the world right now. In this unity that seems to be very united, what are the underlying motivations of it? So you brought up the Korach point, but I think that for me, what screams out about this from a Torah perspective is the Tower of Babel. It seems to be crumbling before our eyes, and it's not pretty. Meaning this divorce that's happening between Britain and the European Union is ugly. It's not an amicable divorce. This is what Nigel Farage said. It was uncomfortable for me to watch. Listen to this.
Funny, isn't it? Thank you very much for that. Very warm welcome. Isn't it funny? You know, when I came here 17 years ago, and I said that I wanted to lead a campaign to get Britain to leave the European Union, you all laughed at me. Well, I have to say, you're not laughing now, are you? And the reason you're so upset, the reason you're so angry, has been perfectly clear from all the angry exchanges this morning. You, as a political project, are in denial. You're in denial that your currency is failing. You're in denial. Well, just look at the Mediterranean. No. As a policy to impose poverty on Greece and the rest of the Mediterranean, you've done very well. And you're in denial over Mrs. Merkel's call last year for as many people as possible to cross the Mediterranean into the European Union has led to massive divisions between countries and within countries. But the biggest problem you've got, and the reason, the main reason the United Kingdom voted the way that it did, is you have, by stealth, by deception, without ever telling the truth to the British or the rest of the peoples of Europe, you have imposed upon them a political union. You've imposed upon them a political union. And when the people in 2005 in the Netherlands and France voted against that political union, when they rejected the Constitution, you simply ignored them and brought the Lisbon Treaty in through the back door. What happened? What happened last Thursday was a remarkable result. It was indeed a seismic result, not just for British politics, for European politics, but perhaps even for global politics too. Because what the little people did, what the ordinary people did, what the people who have been oppressed over the last few years and seen their living standards go down. They rejected the multinationals. They rejected the merchant banks. They rejected big politics. And they said, actually, we want our country back. We want our fishing waters back. We want our borders back. We want to be an independent, self-governing, normal nation. And that is what we have done, and that is what must happen. And in doing so, we now offer a beacon of hope to Democrats across the rest of the European continent. I'll make one prediction this morning. The United Kingdom will not be the last member state to leave the European Union. So the question is, what do we do next? Now, it is up to the British government to invoke Article 50. And I have to say that I don't think we should spend too long in doing it. I totally agree, Mr. Juncker, that the British people have voted. We need to make sure that it happens. But what I would like to see is a grown-up and sensible attitude to how we negotiate a different relationship. Now I know that virtually none of you have ever done a proper job in your lives or worked in business or worked in trade or indeed ever created a job. But listen, you're quite right, Mr. Schultz. UKIP used to protest against the establishment, and now the establishment protests against UKIP. So something has happened here. Let us listen to some simple, pragmatic economics. Between your countries and my country, we do an enormous amount of business in goods and services. That trade is mutually beneficial to both of us. That trade matters. If you were to decide to cut off your noses, to spite your faces, and to reject any idea of a sensible trade deal, the consequences would be far worse for you than it would be for us. And even no deal is better for the United Kingdom than the current rotten deal that we've got. But if we were to move to a position where tariffs were reintroduced on products like motor cars, then hundreds of thousands of German workers would risk losing their jobs. So why don't we just be pragmatic, sensible, grown up, realistic, and let's cut between us a sensible tariff-free deal and thereafter recognise that the United Kingdom will be your friend, that we will trade with you, we will cooperate with you, we will be your best friends in the world. But do that, do it sensibly, and allow us to go off and pursue our global ambitions and future. Thank you.
And then after the cessation happened, then the Chancellor of the European Union, Jean-Claude Juncker, he then turned to the British in the European Union, probably the last appearance there, and he said this.
That's the last time you are applauding here. And to some extent, I'm really surprised that you are here. You were fighting for the exit. The British people voted in favor of the exit. Why are you here?
So this unbreakable, seemingly unbreakable fortress of European superpower is crumbling before our eyes. But it makes sense once it's crumbled. Now that it's crumbling, you see that no matter how high a tower can get, how solid and impenetrable it seems to be, if the edifice of it, if the foundation of it is not solid, then it could just crumble. And that's what's happening right now. Because what is the, Jeremy, what's the motivations from your perspective that brought this whole European Union together?
Europe has some sort of nitya, some sort of leaning towards constantly wanting to melt everyone into their ideology. It happened with the Catholic Crusades, where they went on this Catholic Roman Empire to make everyone Catholic. It happened again in communism, where everyone must be communist. It happened again in Nazism, where everyone must become Nazis, and everyone like was being slowly but surely conquered under the swastika and joined the Nazi regime. And then it's like this new version, a more enlightened version, a more peaceful version, but it was controlling nonetheless. And there's this just inner desire to want to control and unify everyone under some type of order, some type of bureaucracy. I think it comes down to personal power and interests. Maybe there's some rich people behind them that are banks that are behind them. I don't know who the interests are, but it's clearly a matter of controlling the masses.
Right, so there's definitely control there. There's ideology there. Control is a big part of it. There's also just a lot of pragmatic reasons. There's currency, trade, movement, commerce, and just the ability as a union to twist the arm of Israel or anyone else. There's a lot of power that can be exerted there as well. Power, control, these are all elements of it. And when did we see the whole world coming together for this same purpose, right? With the Tower of Babel. Initially, it seemed to be a really beautiful thing. Unity. Unity is a good thing. Everybody's coming together. But when you looked at their motivations, you know, in grade school, we learned like, oh, they were trying to build a tower so high that they would go up and defeat God. And I was picturing them with bows and arrows trying to shoot that in the air at God or however that would look. But really on a deeper level, our sages tell us that what were they trying to do? They saw what happened the generation before when the world was evil. And God steps in and wipes it out with a flood. And they didn't want to, forfeit that control to God. They want to be however they want to be. They want to be evil, so they're going to build a tower so high that they can be evil and do whatever they want. And then when that flood comes, they'll go up into that tower and the flood won't get them. And that's why when their languages were all shifted up and jumbled around, they were throwing bricks at each other's heads. Because it showed that that's how deep their unity was. It was just a pragmatic, superficial type of unity, and they ended up crumbling. The whole thing crumbled right before their eyes, and that's what I see happening right now in the European Union. You want to say something? I'm not done here, but you go ahead.
Well, yeah, sorry, about the crumbling of the European Union, I can't help but rejoice. You know, everyone wonders, you know, what about the Holocaust? How could it be that Europe united together and either actively participated in the Holocaust or at least passively facilitated the extermination of Jews? And now it's almost like everything that the Europeans said the Jews were doing to them, taking their jobs, marrying their women, ruining their culture, the Muslims from Syria and around that are coming in, I read just in the last week that every day 7,000 immigrants came into Greece. If you do the math on 7,000 immigrants a day for a year, you come with over 1 million. Greece isn't that big of a country. Soon, Europe is going to be flooded with these Muslims. And I can't help but feel like here is poetic justice that's being done. So I don't shed a tear for the European Union, because as they united together, you know, they were able to together label products from Judea and Samaria. They were able together to pressure Israel to give up land to our enemies. Now it's like one country named Portugal might say something, but who cares what Portugal says? So the fact that their union is falling apart, I think ultimately is a blessing for Israel.
It is a blessing for Israel, and you spoke about that in your video. But I think it's also worth contrasting what's happening to them to Israel. Meaning, no matter how much we as the Jewish people may disagree with each other, no matter how heated it may get, there's this deep recognition that we're this people on a boat in the middle of the ocean. And if one guy is slamming a hole in the bottom of that boat, that what's going to happen, the whole boat's going to sink. We're all in the same boat together. Meaning there's no Jew exit, Jugzit. There's no way that the Jewish people can exit from each other. We're connected and we're bound. And what is it that binds us? It's the deepest held values that unite us. It's the understanding that it's not even just the values and it's not the religion, because we're not a religion. We're a nation and we're a family and we're connected on this family level. And I think that as we see the disunity and the crumbling and the dissolution of the European Union, and we heard, Nigel Farage said he thinks it's going to... This is just the beginning. Well, we're also going to be seeing a union of people coming together, a unity that's happening. And it's not just among the Jewish people. It's among also those out there in the world who love us, who love the God of Israel, who want to be connected with the Jewish people on a deep level, on a spiritual level, values level, and even to a serious degree on a family level. And as there is this dissolution in the world, at the same time, there's a unity that's fomenting within the Jewish people. And that's why I feel like no matter how big the enemies are against us, no matter how the odds that we're facing, they don't stand a chance. Because what is connecting all of us together are these deepest held values and the family connections. And that when you see what's happening in America, it makes me concerned for America because I don't see America united on these value type levels anymore. I feel like there's such a rift and a division in America, and much of America doesn't believe in these biblical values that America itself was founded upon. And the reflection of that is the nomination and the election of democratically elected leaders who are a reflection of the country that is creating tremendous daylight with Israel, distancing themselves from Israel. So in that way, those who don't stand with us are really casting their own lot. They're making their own beds. Anyways, shifting gears for a second, that's not the only thing that's going on in the world. We have these terror attacks that are erupting throughout the world with increasing frequency and lethality. It's getting really bad. We just saw one in Turkey right now, right? And to me, you made this video that you explained the importance of words, of being able to say who the enemy is, to recognize and identify the enemy. Here in Israel, I believe we do have a recognition and an understanding of the enemy that they don't have in America. You know, here's what Prime Minister Netanyahu had to say about who our enemy is.
There's one country that stands in the breach against militant Islam, either of the Shiite variety led by Iran or the Sunni variety led by ISIS. And that's Israel. We're a few
miles. What do you mean by stands in the breach because of your geographical location?
Sure. And our values. And our values. You know, we fight these fanatics. And we're willing to place ourselves, you know, in the breach, as I say. And we do. And by defending ourselves, we also defend the neighborhood around us.
So when you say the right words, when you recognize who the enemy is, then, you know, these words convey ideas and understandings, and those ideas and understandings, they actually dictate policies. And the right policies were able to curb and fight terrorism in a way that they're not able to other places in the world. For example, this attack in Turkey. There was just a huge attack in Turkey. In the backdrop, we have Paris attack. We have the Orlando attack. We had a terrible attack in China and in Brussels. And in all of these attacks, by the way, the amount of fatalities that they've accrued are more than all the attacks we faced over the last year. So clearly there are some policies that we have here in Israel that I think need to be recognized and emulated around the world if they want to curb terror. And one of these things that Donald Trump came out in recognition of. Here's what he had to say about profiling. Listen to what he said.
I think profiling is something that we're going to have to start thinking about as a country, and other countries do it. And you look at Israel, and you look at others, and they do it, and they do it successfully. And, you know, I hate the concept of profiling, but we have to start using common sense, and we have to use our heads.
So the truth is, it's not racial profiling that we do here in Israel. It's called predictive profiling. People don't recognize that. It's this entire series of factors that are all taken into account, from behavior to background to race being one of them. But it's only one of the factors, because to say racial profiling, A, it makes a lot of people uncomfortable because it makes it seem like this is a racial issue. But really, this is not racial at all. This is about jihadist Islam, right? We had on our show recently Mohammed Zawabi. He is an Arab Muslim Zionist, and he's not anti-Israel, but he's really in the exception. But there's a lot of Arab Christians. The exception among the Arab Christians are actually being anti-Israel, definitely vitriolically terrorist-like in their hatred of Israel, meaning that this is not about Arabs. Arabs aren't the problem. The problem is, first and foremost, at the deepest level, jihadist Islam, extreme Islam. Islam is the problem. It's not about a bad race. It's about bad ideas. So this is, and it's, and the people harboring these bad ideas, they're the ones that need to be profiled. So I think, you know, one thing that needs to happen in airports around the world and shopping malls around the world is this profiling. It needs to be stepped up. The fear of offending people by not profiling them is so ludicrous and crazy to me, especially if you say, listen, most Muslims are against this sort of thing. If that's true, right? If Jews in some sci-fi scenario were blowing places up, I feel so strongly against that, but it's so many Jews doing it. If I had to be inconvenienced and taken out of the line and searched, I would happily do that and take a hit for the team of humanity in order not to do that. But this offense that we're afraid of offending them and provoking them, it's totally ridiculous.
Well, I think it's interesting to note that Israel is probably seen as a more dangerous place when you look around the world. But a study just came out saying that the safest airport in the world is Ben Gurion. And I think that probably raises a lot of eyebrows because the last terror attack in Turkey was in their airport. In Brussels, it was in their airport. Terrorists love airports. 9/11, it was an airport. Ben Gurion Airport is considered the safest airport in the world. If you want to travel anywhere in the world and know you're going to be safe, Ben Gurion is the place to go. And I think that there's so much the world needs to... There's so much that the world needs to learn now from Israel. And what's happening is the next step, I believe, of Jewish destiny, where Israel is almost being forced to step into the shoes of leadership, where very soon England, America, Canada are going to look to Israel for guidance on how we profile, on how we secure our airports, on how we deal with issues of democracy, warfare, terrorism. We are on the cutting edge of all of the world's problems. And when we say we're on the front lines, it's not just we're on the front lines, we're also developing all of the morality behind how to wage this war against radical Islam. And the fact that people don't want to acknowledge it as radical Islam is so frustrating. You know, Bernie Sanders came out saying, you can't blame an entire religion for what's happening in Islam. You can't blame Islam for what the terrorists are doing. And I'm wondering, why not? If it's come out of Islam, I want to blame Islam. And even if it's true that it's not all of them, it comes from them. They, and it's an ideology that they're adopting. Someone may be a Baptist in Tennessee and then all of a sudden convert to Islam. It's not like you're born into it. It's not like you're born into the race of Islam. You adopt an ideology, a worldview, and we need to battle that worldview. We need to fight the ideology that's creating these jihadists. And until we can even say that we're fighting against them, how can we even enter into the battlefield of ideas? It's like they're not allowing us to even acknowledge who the enemy is in order to engage in this world of ideas. And I think Israel now, under the leadership of Prime Minister Netanyahu, although there are many things that I disagree with him about, on this issue, he's solid.
So he is solid, and I think that the fate of Israel right now is solid, and I think we need to really be following your lead, Jeremy, stepping up to the plate as the Jewish people and projecting a message of truth, because we're in a war of ideas right now. It's a spiritual war, and if we don't fight it on that front, there's no chance of victory, and if we do, there's no chance of defeat. That's the end of the story. And to all of our listeners out there, we're doing this Cause Match campaign right now, and it's critical. How many years have you been listening to us? We don't go and say, new campaign, ask for money. This is a very, very important campaign. I feel like we've put our money into this, our own funds from our own very diminished, depleted bank accounts we're putting into this. And I feel like investing in this on a tzedakah level, being able to be a part of this movement we're doing by going into the hills of Judea and establishing a headquarters that's also strategically important for the state of Israel on every front. It's like investing in this is like, you know, meeting Larry Page in his dorm room of Google and saying, hey, can I have a piece of the company for a few $100? That's what it feels like for me. So if you want to be a part of this, it would bring you joy to be a part of this, then please go to our website, thelandofisrael.com. Go to the donate button. It will not take you to the normal. It will take you to the Cause Match campaign. And everything you give is being doubled, meaning that we have donors that have said, if we get the 50, we'll get the other 50. And that would really free us up in allowing us to move forward powerfully. You know, we don't have a Saudi Arabia funding us like Al Jazeera does. We have all of you. So thank you so much for listening to us. This is Ari Abramowitz from Jerusalem with Lieutenant Colonel Jeremy Gimpel, and signing out. Shalom from Jerusalem.
Rabbi Isaac Nissenbaum, one of the founders of the religious Zionist Mizrahi movement, wrote, "The objective of Mizrahi is the total revival of our nation in all its aspects, to revive Judaism in our hearts and to revive our hearts for Judaism. The Land of Israel Network is powered by the Mizrahi World Movement."
Have you ever planted a grapevine? What if the grapevine happened to be in the Land of Israel? Not only that, but if you were a Christian planting this grapevine in the mountains of Israel, you would be fulfilling prophecy that Isaiah and Jeremiah foretold more than 3,000 years ago. I'm Joshua Waller with Hayuvel, and I invite you to fulfill prophecy on the mountains of Israel by joining us this harvest. Go to Hayuvel.com, that's HAYOVEL.com for more information. God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob.